From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, this is Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge. A playwright born and raised in North Carolina is lighting up the stage with the premiere of her new play, The Game. Becca Brunstetter is not afraid to include a little bit of Southern culture and politics in her work.
Because I just realized I had a really unique opportunity to write about Southern people in what I hope is a grounded and real way.
But first, there is political drama playing out in several states over a federal program that helps feed needy school children during the summer. While the bill to approve this summer food program was passed with bipartisan federal support, several states with Republican leadership, like South Carolina, have declined to even show interest in the program. But South Carolina State Senator Katrina Sheely is trying to change minds, with summer break just around the corner. Senator Sheely, welcome to Due South.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, Senator Sheely, you are a Republican, and you recently wrote an op-ed piece published in The Post and Courier in Charleston, along with one of your Democratic colleagues, about how, I guess, Governor Henry McMaster, I guess, has it all wrong when it comes to feeding kids in the summer. What can you tell me about your stance on that?
Senator Jackson and I, we both feel the same way about feeding kids all year long. And, you know, we have trouble getting free meals for kids during the year, you know, during the school year. But this was something that we, you know, the federal government was going to, we could draw down $65 million. We just had to have a small investment of $3 million, which compared to $65 million, that's not very much. And we did it last year because we had the money from COVID. So we could, you know, continue to do that because, you know, the kids need these meals. A lot of these children don't have summer meals at all. They depend on their food at school all year long. So I'm a large advocate for children anyway. They call me the Senator for the Children on both sides of the aisle. So when we saw this, you know, Senator Jackson and I both went to the governor and asked him, you know, please let's draw down that money. He said, well, the time's already passed. I said, no, they're giving us more time to go back and do it. And I think they just didn't want to draw down the money because it was from the federal government. And I don't understand that because somebody's going to get that money. And it might as well be the children here in South Carolina. I can't understand his logic there, but that's what it is.
So the summer, the federal summer electronic benefit transfer, or EBT, it would give families, what, $40 a month for eligible children over the summer. And that's for a total of 3 months. So if it's not about the money, then why do you think, I mean, the governor just won't do that? I know some other governors have said, oh, it's welfare, and I don't believe in welfare.
Well, I can't say what he's thinking, but I can tell you that there's no reason that we shouldn't have taken that money. I mean, I can't answer for him because that would not be a good thing. I say that we should have taken that money. It was $65 million that we could have taken to feed our children at the cost of $3 million, which would have, you know, that's what we would have had to put to administer it. But it would have been $65 million back in the coffers of South Carolina to feed our children. And the $40, you know, per child, that's not a lot of money when you think about it, but that would help to buy them fresh food and vegetables and those type things that they don't get every day during the summer. So, and some kids, you know, if their parents work, they might not get a good breakfast or a good lunch. Or, you know, some kids don't get anything, you know, when their parents aren't home.
So this program is specifically for kids who are already on free and reduced lunch. And so in South Carolina, how many children are we talking about?
I think it's 5,000. But we did get, I have one concession that I got this year for next year. that we are going to, all the children that are on free and reduced lunch, all the reduced lunch is going away and they will be free next year. So no one will be paying reduced lunch next year. They will all be free. So I think we'll have more children signed up for the free lunch next year. And hopefully we'll get the governor to sign on board for this for next year. I'm trying to get free lunch, free breakfast and lunch for all children. So no child has to be, you know, singled out, you know, to get the free lunch.
So South Carolina, you know, is not the only state that's seems to be turning down this program, you know, Alabama, Alaska, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, and then some, you know, out west, you know, like Oklahoma. Why do you think these states are turning it down? Because when you look at all the, say, the states with Democratic governors, they've seemed to have signed on, but still it's like 50-50 with the Republican governors that that have not signed on to this.
You know, like I said earlier, I wish I could understand their mindset. I'm a Republican. I'm all for feeding our children, you know, and I don't think it should be about whether it's welfare, because somebody's going to get the money and it should be our children. You know, I don't think it should, they should consider it that, you know, it's the people who need it the most are the ones that should get the, you know, the food, the EBT cards, you know. That's who should get those, you know, the money. So I can't answer why somebody won't do something. I just know how I feel about it and how Senator Jackson feels about it. And we have asked and, you know, we got turned down.
So are you optimistic? You mentioned there's still time. Are you optimistic that Governor McMaster will change his mind? Just like the governor of Nebraska, I think he changed his mind recently.
Well, we have talked to him, and, you know, I'll talk with him again. Do I think he'll change his mind this year? No. You know, I can say that I can pretty well say with assurance he's not going to change his mind, because it's almost summer now. You know, kids have, what, another 4 weeks of school? We have another 4 weeks of session. So, you know, we're going to be out of here in a couple weeks. So I wish you would, because kids are going to need that, you know, food for the summer. And it's left up to churches and other places to make sure that they have, you know, food for the summer.
So even though this particular program would definitely help children and families in need, I guess it also has a positive impact on the economy, I guess the state economy and the local economy. What can you tell me about that?
Well, when you talk about putting $65 million back into the economy, that's a huge amount of money. So I don't understand it, but I can only answer for Katrina. I can't answer for the governor.
Well, do you think this should be a political issue? It seems to be pretty bipartisan in many places, even the federal government. You know, both parties came together to actually approve this. But I wonder if it's becoming more partisan as it heads to the states.
I don't think it should be a political issue. I think when it comes to children and families, you know, there are certain things that shouldn't be political. Children, families, veterans, the elderly, you know, the most vulnerable people in our society should not be political. And those are the people that I think we should, you know, take care of. Do we always do that? No, we try and make things political that shouldn't be.
I know you're from, is it Lexington?
That's right.
So I wonder, like, I guess personally or even politically, what's your next move? You know, is there anything you can do in your district, you know, to help with this problem this summer?
Well, if you saw my district, you would tell me I would be committing political suicide. I'm probably from the reddest district in the state, or one of them. But I think the people in my district understand, you know, where my heart is, and they know. So, you know, we try and work together to, I have a foundation for children that helps children in foster care and group homes to fill those extra needs. We give $50 gift cards to families at Thanksgiving and, you know, and Christmas, and even in between then when we know they have a need. So, you know, people just have to work together to help fill those needs.
You mentioned how red your particular community and district is, but have you gotten any pushback for writing that op-ed piece with Democratic State Senator Darrell Jackson?
No. No, I think the people that know me know what my passion is. This isn't wrong. How can it be wrong if you're taking care of children? How can it be wrong if you're taking care of families? And I think it would look really foolish to come back and say, you shouldn't feed children. So I haven't really gotten any pushback. They know I work across party lines because I get more legislation passed than anybody else in the state of South Carolina. I mean, last year I passed 11 pieces of legislation. The next closest was 6. So I don't just work for, I work for what's right, not what's political, but what's right.
So I guess lastly, what would you say to, governors, you're a governor and governors to several other southern states and out west, if you have to make one last ditch effort to make them sign on to this summer EBT program?
I think my one request would be, don't think about politics, think about people. Consider the children, consider if you were in that position. I mean, none of your children or grandchildren are going hungry, but think about the children. Think about those who don't come, maybe they eat a Pop-Tart for supper, or maybe they, don't have anything for supper, a piece of toast. Your children are getting a full meal. They're not. Think about those people. Don't think about politics. It's not politics. It's people.
Well, thank you very much for being with me today, South Carolina State Senator Katrina Shealy. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Nice being here.
This is Due South. I'm Leonita Inge. We'll continue talking about summer lunches for kids in need in just a moment. Welcome back to Due South. I'm Leonita Inge. We're continuing our conversation about summer lunches for children who are out of school and those same children who may struggle to have healthy and consistent food during summer months. And also just a slight addendum to our last segment, South Carolina State Senator Katrina Shealy said about 5,000 children in that state qualify for free and reduced price lunch. She misspoke. There are nearly 500,000 children on free and reduced lunch in South Carolina. Our next guest is Tamara Baker. She's the Project and Communications Director at the Carolina Hunger Initiative. Tamara, welcome to Due South.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You know, we talked about this number in South Carolina in our last segment, how almost, 500,000 children there qualify for free and reduced lunch. How many children are there in that predicament, in that same position here in North Carolina?
The number is close to 1 million children. As a matter of fact, it's almost 70% now are eligible for free and reduced price meals in the state of North Carolina in our public schools.
I was looking at a map across the U.S., and I guess it was a pretty old map because definitely many of the southern states topped 50%, of children who were on free and reduced lunch, for example. But wow, when I saw the 70% mark, I was looking at like Texas and I think even Mississippi, some other states. But so it's rising in North Carolina, it seems.
It is rising. The numbers nationally are that about 1 in 5 children have chronic hunger in the U.S., and in North Carolina, it's 1 in 4 children.
Well, how much of a problem is it getting children food in the summer when they're out of school?
Well, it is a challenge because where are the children? And you know where they are during the school year, but during the summer, it's a challenge. So there have been these traditional programs. There's the summer nutrition program where the kids show up and eat congregate meals. Congregate's a term that just means eat meals in a group setting. And then we now have a new program that started last year where meals can be delivered to communities where families can pick up meals. And that's a great, that's called a non-congregate meal service or meals to go. But this newest program really joins those other two programs to help really fill the gap on the need. And this newest program is called Summer EBT. And people recognize that term EBT is what people who get SNAP benefits or food stamps, or in North Carolina it's called Food Nutrition Service, so the benefits that they already receive. And so this is now the opportunity for the first time for those them to get those benefits during the summer months. It's also called the Sunbucks program. So I'm going to refer to it today as the Sunbucks program, which is the new way that the Department of Agriculture wants to brand the program, because it's quick and easy for families to remember.
So this money that's been approved by the federal government, it's on top of benefits that families are already receiving, because I think it's like $40 a month. Is it per eligible child for 3 months? So over the summer. So this is in addition to the money that they already get. Is that correct?
It is. It is in addition. It's a total of $120 per child. And the benefits will be received in one lump payment onto their, if they have an existing EBD card, or otherwise they'll be mailed an EBT card.
Well, what can that do for a family? How important is this extra money?
Well, the reason it's so important is the recent studies from No Kid Hungry, which is our partner, show that families on average spent about $168 per month in the summer months when their children are home. And I don't know about you, but that's a pretty big hit to most people's budgets. And so this gives an opportunity for families that just simply couldn't get to those summer meals in the past, or that transportation is a big challenge. And North Carolina is a very rural state, so transportation is even a bigger challenge. So having the ability to get extra dollars helps families stretch their grocery budgets. That can be a game changer.
Have you noticed different organizations that really stepped up to the plate? Either they had extra resources or money, especially during the pandemic. Are they still around? Have we seen a decrease in the organizations that are able to help out with families over the summer?
Well, first of all, let me just give a big shout out to both USDA and then the state agencies that run these programs. And in North Carolina, the Department of Health and Human Services runs the Sunbucks program. And in North Carolina, the Department of Public Instruction runs the other two summer nutrition programs. So it starts with them. They're doing a stellar job. They don't have extra staff, but yet they have extra programs now that they're running. And we're just so proud of how hard they are. And they're our partners and working on this every day. But then there are the many, many other organizations that help out, the many groups that are community organizations that feed children. And then, of course, all the school systems. There are 115 traditional school systems in North Carolina that run these programs and do a great job. But then what about the donor base? During the pandemic, we saw a lot of organizations coming forward with additional dollars. And yes, those dollars are not quite as generous as they were. But these federal programs are designed so that they are sustainable and continuous and permanent programs in place, regardless of whether dollars out there to support the donor base.
When I think about the million or so children you say on free and reduced lunch in North Carolina, I can't help but think about the families who are still possibly going hungry, but may not have that designation. You know, maybe they didn't fill out the right paperwork or the forms to even get this supplemental money, for example. So how much of an increase are we talking about when we look at those numbers?
Well, you're actually referring to a really important group. Only about 60% are actually filled out the forms on our own. The free and reduced price meals program. And there's another close to 10% that probably is there because North Carolina really was ambitious and undertook the direct certification, which means if a child was already on Medicaid, then the two agencies worked together and they made sure the child was then going to be able to get the free meals regardless. And that's important to know, because if children are participating in other federal programs besides just the FRP, then they are going to automatically get these benefits.
Another thing I definitely wanted to mention, our guest from South Carolina talked about a new program in that state, she says, next summer, that all students who are on free and reduced lunch will be getting lunch completely free. You know, is that something you've heard of? Is North Carolina doing that?
You're talking get lunch free during the school year?
During the school year.
Yes. As a matter of fact, we definitely are very interested in that in North Carolina. And Carolina Hunger Initiative is part of an effort called School Meals for All North Carolina. And you can find it by that schoolmealsforallnc.org. And that is exactly the goal, is to try to work towards making sure that children have the consistency of these meals no matter what, and having both lunch and breakfast at school available at no cost is the goal of that program. And it's an awesome mission.
And lastly, I guess, what is the Carolina Hunger Initiative doing to really keep this topic at the top of the list, the top of lawmakers' lists when they, when they're negotiating what's best for our children?
We're shouting it from every rooftop that we can, but there is a tremendous need there that families are still suffering, and families continue to suffer. And we know that prices are not what we all wish they were for anything, for rent, for transportation, for food. And so we just encourage everyone who has an interest in this to think about the ways that you can be supportive. And especially we want to create awareness of the fact that families have benefits that are not being accessed. And the hope is that they will be able to pursue making sure that they're getting these benefits. This summer, we're expecting from this Sunbucks program that 1 million children in North Carolina are expected to receive benefits. And that represents $120 million in state and into the state in food assistance benefits. That's a big boost to the economy. Those are local dollars that will be spent invested in groceries in North Carolina. So we're pretty excited about that potential as well. Mm-hmm.
Is this expanding the pandemic era solutions to make sure children have lunch during the summer?
As a matter of fact, we learned there was a benefits program then called PEBT or Pandemic EBT, and we learned that that really helped families. And this is a different program, but it's similar in that those benefits were giving directly to families and tremendously helped to decrease child hunger issues in communities. One other thing that I didn't share is that we knew in past years that nationwide, 6 out of 7 eligible kids have not been able to access the existing summer programs. So this is a boost to give families an option of being able to receive benefits that are so critical to their family's well-being and their grocery budgets.
Well, what can you tell me about, know more about North Carolina children? Like when you say 1 in 4, are in need of this, this supplemental food over the summer, where are these children?
Well, North Carolina is a very rural state. And it's hard to find anywhere in North Carolina, though, where there is not need. And it's especially prevalent in rural North Carolina, which is more than 80 of our 100 counties. But even in the most urban areas, you find tremendous needs. So they're everywhere. If you're talking 70% of the school children, then it's hard to find a school that doesn't have need. And therefore, those students need help during the summer. There's a big challenge also called summer learning loss. And the teachers will tell you that when kids come back in August, that they're just really concerned about their literacy skills, their skills across the board. Well, part of that is the fact that nutrition will help with that summer learning loss because it gives them the fuel they need to be able to kickstart their minds as they start back to school.
Well, thank you very much. I've heard that many times over the years. Hungry kids cannot learn.
Very true. Very true. So we're just grateful that you want to speak with us today and that we get to share this important message so that families will know this is coming. And if not, then they can also apply. They can go to the website ncdhhs.gov/sunbucks and learn more about this program.
Well, Tamara Baker is with the Carolina Hunger Initiative. Thanks for joining us on Due South.
Thank you so much. Really pleasure talking with you today.
This is Due South. I'm Leonida Inge. Here to continue our conversation on this new summer EBT program, which is totally rebranded as Sunbucks, is Madhu Willamiri. She's the Deputy Director of the Division of Child and Family Well-Being with the North Carolina State Health Department. Madhu Willamiri, thank you and welcome to Due South.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, please explain to me, what is Summer Bucks? I know we've been calling it Summer EBT, but we're talking about money for families who need it over the summer.
We are. And to start, I think I want to say why it's important, which is that about one in four children in North Carolina face food insecurity or chronic hunger. And on top of that, summer is often the hungriest time of year because many of the meals that kids were receiving during the school year go away, and their families may end up struggling to make ends meet to put food on the table. So to help close that hunger gap for children during the summer, the United States Department of Agriculture, or the USDA, has launched a new permanent program called Sunbucks, also known as Summer EBT, to provide food assistance to kids and families during the summer. And North Carolina is really excited. We are launching Sunbucks this summer for the first time to school-aged children who are otherwise missing out on meals when schools are closed during the summer. And we're really proud that North Carolina will be one of 36 states that are launching Sunbucks for the first time this summer, and one of three states in the Southeast region.
Mm. For those families who qualify, what do you need to do to make sure you get Sunbucks?
That's a great question. So first, I'll just explain what Sunbucks will provide. Families who are eligible will get a one-time payment of $120 per eligible child during the summer period. And the benefits will be delivered to families on a debit-like card where families can purchase groceries at retailers that accept EBT, which should include most grocery stores. And so most children who are eligible for Sunbucks will actually automatically qualify for the program. There will be some families who may need to apply, and families who are going to need to apply should be on the lookout for a text message or email from the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services with more information about the application. And we are continuing to post information about Sunbucks on our website, which is www.ncdhhs.gov/sunbucks.
So I've heard, I guess, one of the benefits of this particular program is its flexibility. That is it maybe easier than other forms of federal benefits to cover the cost of food?
So that is definitely a benefit where Sunbucks benefits can be used to buy food at authorized retailers that take EBT, as I mentioned, most large grocery stores, some farmers markets, even some online retailers. And the benefits allow for families to buy foods such as bread, cereal, fruits, vegetables, meat, fish, chicken, and dairy, even seeds and plants that will make food. Importantly, families cannot buy beer, wine, liquor, things that aren't food, or food that's already hot and prepared. But there is, in general, a lot of flexibility for how families actually spend their dollars to buy the nutritious food that best meets their family's needs. Yes.
Mm. So I guess one thing I definitely wanted to know, you know, just really, how big of a deal is this? Because we know back during the pandemic, I guess there was something similar. So I guess this is good news. In a way, this is a continuation. I guess we saw that there was still need.
Absolutely, this is good news. So what you're referring to is North Carolina was able to, with Sunbucks, were able to build off the success of a program called Pandemic EBT that we operated during the COVID-19 pandemic. In North Carolina, we launched it in 2020, early in the pandemic, and we operated it through 2023, and we were able to issue over $2.5 billion in food assistance benefits to over 1.7 million students and young children in North Carolina to help their families afford nutritious meals. And Sunbucks is certainly building upon the success of the Pandemic EBT program. It is a different program. It is now going to be a permanent program every summer, and it is providing that $120 benefit per eligible child. And we are really excited that in North Carolina, we are estimating that nearly a million students in our state are going to be able to get these benefits, and that'll translate to roughly $120 million in benefits that go directly into families' pockets to pay for food, but also end up getting spent in our local retailers and boosting our economy and putting money into the food system.
Well, I guess that's definitely overall good news for really probably hundreds of thousands of families. And as you said, you know, over a million children. Well, thank you so much for being with me. We just spoke with Madhu Vulamiri. She's with the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking about how North Carolinians can get these Sunbucks from the summer EBT program for children who are out of school for the summer and otherwise might have had a hard time getting food. Just ahead, my conversation with a North Carolina born and raised playwright. This is Due South. Welcome back to Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge. How far would you go to save your marriage? And what if the thing driving a wedge between you was none other than a video game? That's the premise of The Game, a new play debuting at UNC's Playmakers Repertory Theater running through April 28th. It's a modern-day interpretation of the ancient Greek comedy Lysistrata. I'm here with the playwright Becca Brunstetter. Becca is a native North Carolinian and a graduate of UNC Chapel Hill, who's made a name for herself in Hollywood, writing for shows like Made on Netflix and NBC's This Is Us. Most recently, she wrote for the Broadway musical adaptation of The Notebook. Becca, welcome to Due South.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I saw The Game, right?
Oh, you did?
Yes, I did.
Oh, thank you for going.
I saw The Game during an exclusive preview, you know, like their last rehearsal, dress rehearsal before the big day. And I was surprised. I mean, I saw the play Lysistrata in college a million years ago and almost forgot, you know, how funny it was. And I tell you really how appropriate it was. So tell me, what made you decide to adapt that Greek story into something that we'd all understand today?
Yeah, well, I wish I could take full credit, but Vivian Benesch, the director of the show and also the artistic director of Playmakers, it was her idea. She called me back in 2021 and asked me if I would do a Lysistrata adaptation for them, a big comedy. And I'm not typically a comedy writer. I kind of fancy myself more as a dramedy writer. I sort of hover between the funny and the sad. I, you know, also try to find some like heart and some weight too, because it's very much a play about marriage and friendship and community.
So there's sex.
And sex.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
A lot of sex.
There's some sex comedy. There has to be. I mean, Lysistrata, the people love to laugh at sex, you know, thousands of years ago and now. It's very clear. So
and
yeah,
even
there's that.
Today, it's funny when someone, or women, you know, stand up and say, "We're going to withhold sex."
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I could see when I looked across the audience. I mean, people were quiet as though they never thought that ever happened before.
Right, Right. Well, it's happened. It's interesting. It's happened. And I put some examples in the play. It's happened all throughout history. And recently, very recently, it's a really common weapon.
Now, the weapon I saw in this play was that video game console.
Mm-hmm.
And that definitely, if anything can make a play modern, that can do it. I have to ask you, I mean, the play moved so smoothly. I always wonder with writers, especially good writers, you know, how much of, how many examples of your life made it into that play?
I got the idea for the play, you know, inspired from by my own marriage. My husband loves video games. I don't understand them. I don't play them. I don't see their value. So I've had to go on this sort of like long learning process of coming to understand them and understand what they do for him. And a part of that process has been me realizing the things that I do to avoid work, the things that I do to avoid reality. And while I don't play games, sometimes when I'm avoiding work or stressed, I'll just like decide that I need red pants and I'll spend an absurd amount of time looking at red pants. 'Cause we all have things that we do to avoid work and to avoid reality. And those things are now these days typically on our phones.
I know. And we're not perfect.
Not at all. Not at all.
And that's what this play showed, that no matter how you felt about what somebody else does, if they play too many video games, you're not perfect either.
Exactly.
Very clear. So
judge not, lest you be judged, you know.
So what was it, you know, like debuting this play at the same university where you were a student?
It's just this incredible full circle feeling. And as you mentioned, I'm just fresh off my Broadway debut. I mean, this play started rehearsal 2 days before The Notebook premiered in New York. So I had that ginormous life experience, and then I got to come home to this. And the two things happening kind of at the same time is just how life is, you know? It's just one of those crazy things. But I really needed to come here. I didn't know how badly I needed to come here and work on my next play after The Notebook until I was here. And I was like, wow, I really needed this grounding and this centering right now.
Now, would you say in your work, there's some common themes? Because I believe in writing what you know, because it'll sound more authentic. People will grasp the humor or the drama, right? But I guess in some of your work, do I feel like a Southern setting of some sort, maybe? Mm-hmm. Religion? Conservatism as a concept. So maybe you can talk about that a little bit.
Absolutely. I set a lot of my plays in North Carolina, in Winston-Salem, where I'm from, because I just realized, especially once I left North Carolina, I went straight to grad school at the New School for Drama in New York. Over time, and I was in New York for 10 years, and now I've been out in LA doing TV for about 10 years. I over the years just realized I had a really unique opportunity to write about Southern people in what I hope is a grounded and real way. And you know, exactly like you said, the only way I know how to write is from my own experience. So I'm just constantly mining my own fears and questions and insecurities. And a lot of those have to do with faith. So I come back to that bucket a lot. I want to say that I'm old enough now to know what I believe, but I think I'm only old enough now to realize I'll never really know. And that question is going to evolve and change until I die. So a lot of religion. But I think kind of what's at the heart of everything I do is empathy, and just getting at this feeling of, you know, our attempt to understand each other at all times, because that's kind of become more dire than ever as the world gets more complicated. And in a way, this play is just another contribution to that canon, but it's, you know, within a marriage as opposed to people with different religious or political views.
Becca Brunstetter is a playwright and screenwriter. Her latest works are The Notebook on Broadway and The Game. Did you write The Cake?
I did write The Cake.
I remember The Cake. I thought you wrote The Cake.
I did.
And that's what made me, think about just that conservative theme. And then tell our audience about The Cake.
Oh, The Cake. The Cake I wrote back in 2015, I believe, was the first draft. It was inspired by the case that eventually went to the Supreme Court, happened in Colorado, where a baker didn't want to bake a cake for two men who were getting married. I decided to take that, put it in North Carolina at a fictionalized version of my favorite bakery, Dewey's.
And make it two women.
Yeah, and make it two women.
Yes.
So I kind of put my own spin on it. And I wanted to put a conservative person in a play and have her kind of be the hero and really look at her values and see what would happen to this woman if her surrogate daughter, her late best friend's daughter, comes home with a woman and she's really forced to look at her belief system and look at her values.
Jenny came in the store today.
Jenny's in town?
She is.
Well, we gotta have her over. You could make that cornflake fried chicken.
I'll ask her.
Or is she still pretending she don't eat meat? Last time she was down, remember that? Took her to Little Richard's. I watched that girl eat a plate of just green beans and collards. It was upsetting. Honestly, I got upset. She's getting all corrupted by the liberals up there. Sweat yoga and all of that.
I think she was just experimenting.
That's how it starts. It starts small with experiments just because everyone else is doing them. Next thing you know, you forget who you are, where you came from.
She's getting married.
That is wonderful news. Who's the lucky guy?
The lucky guy is. It is a woman.
What?
Don't say what when you, I know you heard me. We're both sitting right here.
It's been the greatest gift of my career because I get to hear from people all over the country and all over the world and little theaters are doing it. It's a 4-person cast.
I enjoyed it. I saw it at UNC,
yeah,
actually.
It was
at the
so
Repertory
wonderful
Theater.
That they did it here. That was a dream come true. And I just get these beautiful messages of, and this was my dream for the play, that like small theaters would do it and like pastors would come to see it. Gay people who are struggling with their relationships with their parents, like everyone, just kind of trans people, everyone's sitting together in these little theaters watching this one story and hopefully laughing and feeling. And that's kind of what's happened with the play. And it's amazing. It's like a dream come true. If I never do anything better, that's fine.
And well, I'm glad I mentioned The Cake. You know, the game that's your newest work, it also included a lesbian couple,
mm-hmm.
a same-sex couple. It included a Black woman. It included an older woman. It's like you made sure you included a very diverse group of characters, which I think made for a great blend and for a great comedy.
Yeah, that was really important to me because, you know, the play is very much about community. My husband plays a lot of games with his father, with his uncle, but then also like friends that he's made, you know, playing the game and friends that don't live where he lives that he wants to stay close to. And I was interested in, you know, the flip side of that, how women make friends and how we keep our friends close to us. And in a way, I think we tend to, you know, with the friends that we keep close to us, we keep people around us who we share similar values with. And, you know, in a way that kind of keeps our world safe. But with the play, the game, you know, it's a group of strangers who have never met each other. And they're sort of forced into this intimacy of friendship pretty quickly. But they're also really different women. And so they're kind of learning from each other and blowing each other's minds and rubbing off on each other. And I really wanted to try and dramatize that electricity.
You know, how has being a Southerner helped are hindered you in Hollywood and in theater?
Oh, that is such an interesting question. I feel like it's been a gift because I have just kind of like an insider POV. I feel like there's a lot of like people writing about the South who have never lived here, who don't fully get it. And so I get to sort of like have a deeper understanding. But I will also say, you know, I haven't lived here since I was 22. And so there's a disconnect. And as much as, you know, my family still lives here, I'm here all the time. I listen to country music every day. You know, I bake a lot of Southern foods and cook a lot of Southern foods. It's very much in my DNA and in my life. But I get it wrong, too. You know, sometimes when I'm writing a character who lives here or thinking about a story that takes place here, I have a disconnect as well because I haven't been here in so many
years. And then
you have
to get on an airplane and come home.
I know.
And take a look around.
I just try, whenever I do get the chance to come here, I just try and listen and observe and just, but it's evolving, you know? I mean, Durham is different. Chapel Hill is different. Winston's different. It's evolving. So yeah, trying to keep up.
I know. Before I let you go, you know, I'm a big fan of This Is Us. And I know you spent several years just moving on up through that show, starting off as a staff writer. But is there an episode that you feel you got to touch clearly that really was meaningful to you?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. The Waiting Room. The Waiting Room. It's season 3. All of the characters are stuck in a waiting room. I think Kate is in labor.
Mm.
So we've got Kate on antibiotics.
So what you're saying, Kate has an infection?
No, but there is a risk. Have you all been here since Kate was admitted?
We all arrived at different times, but yes, sir, 26 hours. Do we smell like it?
There's really no need for all of you to stay. We'll call you if we have any news. Feel free to freshen up, get some normal food.
We're staying.
I know you feel like
this family stays.
The showrunners came to me and said, "Becca, we want you to write a play. We want you to write a 50-minute, you know, waiting room play with the characters sort of trapped in the space, wondering whether or not their loved one was going to live or die." And it was just so cool that they asked me to do that, knowing I'm a playwright, and gave me permission to be myself in an episode of television. And it turned out great. One of the reasons I think it turned out so well is because we've got a lot of theater actors in the show. Sterling K. Brown is a theater actor. Chris Sullivan's a theater actor. Like so they knew exactly what to do. It was awesome.
Well, I mean, you're working on so many things now. Got to get through The Notebook, got to get through The Game, but anything else on your plate?
Oh, man, I have another musical that I've been working on concurrently that we did at The Olney, which is a theater in Maryland a few years ago that we're hopefully finding a home for next. But it is called AD 16, and it's about teenage Mary Magdalene falling in love with teenage Jesus.
Oh, my God.
And it takes place in Nazareth.
So
and
I
it's
knew
a delight.
You had a religious theme going
yes,
through your work. Oh, my.
Jesus just finds me, man. He just like, I'm not even always seeking it out. He's just like, hey, Becca. But it's a really fun show, and hopefully we'll be finding the next step for it really soon.
Well, Becca, thank you for bringing so much of you into your work, because many of us have enjoyed it over the years.
Oh, my pleasure.
Becca Brunstetter is a playwright and screenwriter. Her latest works are The Notebook on Broadway and The Game, and she's from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. This is Due South. Due South is a production of WUNC and a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our producers are Stacia Brown, Cole Del Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Denarius Thomas is our technical director. Aaron Kiever is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Quilla. Jeff DeBerry is my co-host, and I'm Leonita Inge. No need to pretend. She got a little bit of drum with her friends. Time's a little dreamy, riding in a bus. You don't smoke, but it's cool with your friends.